This is the second podcast in our series exploring the history of class struggle in Britain. In this episode, we're discussing the tumultuous events of the Civil War in the 17th century, its origins and its impact on society then and now. I'm joined by John Rees, research fellow at Goldsmiths University, renowned political activist and author of The Leveller Revolution, looking at radical political organisation in the 17th century. Also by Anne Hughes, Professor of History at Keele University, with a specific interest in the culture, religion and politics of the English Civil War, or the English Revolution, as she prefers to call it. I'm also joined by Ted Valance, Professor of Early Modern History and Political Culture at the University of Roehampton. He specialises in the 17th century and he's the author of the well-known A Radical History of Britain. We're discussing the period between 1625, when Charles I came to the throne, and 1660, when Charles II, his son, was acclaimed king. To recap very briefly on the events of this period, Charles I succeeds his father, James I of England, and James VI of Scotland. The combination of the religious reforms he sought to impose on society, the taxes he levied to finance wars to unite Scotland and Ireland under his rule, and his refusal to accept Parliament's fettering of his divine right to rule, created tensions and conflicts that eventually spilled over into armed conflict in the first period of civil war from 1642 to 1646. The conflict between royalists, the Cavalier army, and the parliamentarians, the roundheads, was bitter and bloody with heavy casualties. The first period of the war ends with the defeat and arrest of Charles, but he escapes and allies himself with the Scottish Covenanters invading from the north. This invasion is defeated by Cromwell, now leading his new model army, and Charles is executed for treason in 1649. The Commonwealth is established under Parliament. Throughout this period, there had been intense popular religious and political debate, drawing on the mass publication of pamphlets and public debates exemplified by the Putney debates within the army about the nature of democracy and civil rights, with new currents forming around groups like the Levellers and the Diggers. A further war ensues when Charles II leads a further invasion from Scotland and is defeated. The army adopted in 1653 the instrument of government, making Oliver Cromwell Lord Protector, and the Protectorate is established, with Parliament subsequently dissolved. After Oliver Cromwell's death and a brief period of rule by his son Richard, the grandees of the new model army removed him, and a deal was done with Charles II, pardoning crimes committed during the Civil War, except the regicide, and Charles was declared lawful king in May 1660. Let's now discuss in more detail the background, causes, and yes, the impact of the Civil War. Ted, let me come to you first of all. Just explain the arrangements of society in the 17th century.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a mainly agrarian and rural society. I mean, the one exception to this is London, which grows massively over the period. And by the middle of the century, is the largest city in Western Europe. But it's an anomaly in terms of English urban centres, which are all much smaller than London. And in a way, there's a kind of similar effect to we see with London today, in that London's size is, a lot of it is due to inward migration from people coming from the provinces into London seeking work. So London is this kind of anomaly. There's this really large urban centre. It's the political centre. It's also, you know, the legal centre as well. It's where trade guilds are based. So London stands out of a society that, broadly speaking, is still rural and agrarian. And which is still very socially stratified, although we're not talking as we were, in the previous week's chat about a society in which, you know, the majority of people are literally peasants. We are talking about a society in which people, labourers, you know, they're wage labourers, tenant farmers, and and considerable freedom of movement as well, in terms of people moving to seek work as well. So there's quite a bit of migration, particularly at the lowest ends of society as well. So in terms of the economy, you know, still a lot of it is based around agriculture, although there is an increasing mercantile interest as well in the country, which, you know, some historians would argue has an important part to play in the Civil War as well. But some features of this society will look, you know, like we haven't seen a kind of massive change from the earlier period. I think the other thing that sort of, you know, it is worth kind of stressing, kind of social kind of explanations for the Civil War have kind of gone out of fashion, or you know, to a large extent have gone out of fashion. But we are talking about a society which is under social strain, economic and social strain. There is population growth, but there is sort of, you know, a lack of sort of keeping up in terms of agricultural production with this population growth. So there's considerable, you know, hardship. You know, extreme poverty is a reality, and all of the kinds of pressures and anxieties that come with that. So even though we're not seeing, you know, lots of kind of popular rebellion in the 1620s and 1630s up until we get to the late 1630s, this isn't to say that, you know, society is very comfortable. You know, it's very stable.
What are the political arrangements, Anne?
Well, can I just say a little bit more about social change? Actually, I think it's a society that has, first of all, it's a society that has undergone very significant social and economic change, as Ted has hinted at, in the previous century, with winners and losers. It's one of the most difficult, because great expansion in poverty, but also very significant expansion in what historians rather evasively call the middling householders, some economic independence, medium-sized landowners, small merchants, and so on. And what's interesting about politics is that it's a society where a significant proportion of not poor men, male householders, have some role in how the system works. I mean, at the top, you've obviously got the aristocracy and the landed gentry who run the counties, who sit in parliament and so on. But you also have in every village and in the wards of towns like London or Norwich, you have men who've been sat on juries, who've been constables, who are used to having some control over their own lives and participating in the political process. So I think, as Ted says, social and economic explanations of the Civil War have gone out of fashion. But if we think about not necessarily the causes of the war precisely, but how it was possible to have a civil war that involved significant sections of the population. It wasn't just aristocrats fighting each other. And the way in which it was a civil war that could become, some of us think, a revolution, it was capable of radicalization, then that basis of participation, that accustomed participation of people who weren't poor but weren't rich and had faced significant social strain, social transformations, I think is very important. We should also, I don't know if anyone else wants to talk about, religious change is also very important. It's a society where people believe in God, they believe in a God that's intimately involved in all aspects of their lives, but they disagree about the nature of true religion. And there's been a reformation that's contested and partial. Some people think it's gone too far. Lots of people think it hasn't gone far enough. And that notion that you might be fighting for a cause with that God's cause is very significant, I think, as well.
How, John, is all that reflected then in the high politics of the country at the time? We have, clearly, as Anne has described, we have a growing participation at the local level and also emanating to the national level of a greater participation of a wider range or class of people within politics itself. But how is that reflected in the national debates that are taking place?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, Anne's described it in part, but it's worth reinforcing the point that the state in this era is very, very different to the modern state. There's no standing army. There's no police force. The only people in arms in the society are the so-called trained bands, which are a sort of part-time militia that practice archery and musketry in open spaces sometimes during the year. They aren't very well armed and they aren't very well trained. So for the monarchy to rely on social order, it's got to rely on the justices of the peace, the deputy lieutenants of the counties, the constables and so forth that Anne describes. So if there's a rupture between the central government and these people administering social order in the counties, then you've got an absolutely first-class constitutional crisis. And that's what we begin to see, certainly from the 1620s on. There is an increasing rupture between these two parts of the state. And that's reinforced, as Anne suggested, by the church. And it's worth just kind of elaborating what the church meant in this society, because we live in a very secular society. It's one of the most difficult things, I think, about thinking about the 17th century, to get your head into what the church meant. Now, let's just leave aside the idea, you know, the kind of intellectual process of religious commitment. Let's just concentrate on what it meant as a social institution. So it's playing the role that the mass media, the educational institutions are playing in the civil service, the censorship bodies. These are all church functions. And here's the kicker. You've got to be a member of the Church of England. It's not a voluntary, perhaps I'll go to church this Sunday. If you don't go to church on Sundays, if you aren't a member of your parish church, if you don't have your children baptized in the parish church, you can be dragged before the courts, ultimately fined or imprisoned for not turning up to hear what the priest has been, let's put it this way, agreed that the priest will say by a hierarchy in the church. So this is why James I, Charles's father, says no bishops, no king. You know, if we don't have hierarchy in the church, control of this massive social institution, then we're going to lose control of the state altogether.
Let's move on then. Let's talk about the background to, if you like, the causes to the outbreak of conflict in itself, the triggers of, as Anne says, effectively what is a revolution, not just a civil war, it's a revolution taking place. What are the events that then spilt over into conflict? Ted?
I think, you know, following on from John's comment, one of the really critical things is the church, and the church as well in a British context and not just in an English context. One of the things that I think is deceptive about the picture that we see in the lead up to civil war is that, you know, to all intents and purposes, it looks peaceful. The country is not at war. The country has kind of kept itself out of this major European conflict, the 30 Years' War. And, you know, so things look relatively stable in England. But if you look at what's being discussed in terms of responses to Charles I's religious policy and what Charles I has been doing with his Archbishop William Laud is making significant changes, particularly to the interior fabric of churches and bringing them back more towards what some people see as a kind of Catholic, you know, forms of worship and, you know, elaborate forms of clerical dress, arrangement, railing off of the altar and so forth. All of these things to those people that we broadly call Puritans smack of the return of Catholicism. And the fact that Charles is doing it whilst he's ruling without Parliament, and that's the other thing that's going on in the 1630s is that he's dissolved Parliament at the end of the 1620s and is ruling on his own, looks to some people like royal tyranny. And we used to, you know, you can look at a figure like William Prynne, who comes a cropper in the 1630s to the royal authorities for publishing books against Charles I's bishops. And Prynne is kind of your archetypal stage Puritan. You know, he hates the theatre, he hates fun, he hates long hair. He's, you know, so he's all of our kind of stereotypes of what a Puritan is. But the attacks that he's making on all of that, on stage plays and on Charles's court culture, that we now see that there's actually a much deeper political critique to this, because the allusion that he makes is between Charles and Nero. Nero, the Roman emperor, who was also devoted to his pleasures and to play rather than to, you know, the good government of the people of Rome. And so the implication is that Charles is a tyrant like Nero. Now, in the 1630s, English Puritan opponents of Charles's regime, like Prynne, they get their books out, you know, but they can't do, it doesn't seem like they can do a lot more than that. And they come, you know, cropper, as I said, the hands of the authorities, and Prynne is you know, severely punished and has his ears cropped for the second time. But the issue here is that it, in England, and we've talked about the kind of military resources of the state, there is no longer the kind of aristocratic independent military power to resist the crown as there would have been in the medieval period. So English nobles were certainly talking about in very disparaging terms about Charles I's government in private, but they didn't have the kind of military wherewithal to resist. What changes is that Charles, you know, decides that he wants to bring his Scottish kingdom into religious alliance, greater religious alignment with his English kingdom. So we get the imposition of a new book of prayer on Scotland in 1637. That triggers riots in what is a mostly Presbyterian country, which is the other thing that sort of, you know, an important political feature of the 17th century is the union of crowns of Scotland and England. And this then moves from rioting into outright rebellion, in part because of the way in which Charles responds to this, which is to see this rejection of the prayer book as a direct assault on his authority. So these people are not just people who, you know, don't want these particular kind of, you know, aspects of worship. They are rebels. They are traitors, and they have to be kind of, you know, put down by force. And so it moves into open rebellion in Scotland, in reaction in part to Charles's stance. His Scottish opponents bind themselves together in this document called the National Covenant, and hence they become known as the Covenanters. They form an army. They're led by very experienced generals who've actually got military experience in this European conflict of the 30 Years' War. And basically, you know, the end result of this is that they successfully invade England, they occupy Newcastle, Charles is forced to recall Parliament. I've skipped a few steps there doing this. This is always what happens when you're talking about the Civil War. But I think that the critical thing is that, you know, when we're talking about the kind of triggers, it's the interplay between, you know, this multiple kingdoms context, the centrality of religion, but also the way in which religion is entwined with all sorts of other things, including how people see politics and, you know, the king himself and what his religious policy means in political terms.
What I found extraordinary in reading some of the pamphlets, drafts that all of you have written about, is the way in which Lord becomes such a hate figure, and how intense the debate is around religion and the threat of popery, as they describe it, and then the association with the king. Just on the ideological plane, Anne, what's going on here? Is it Is it just about religion, or is it class as well, or are there other factors in the debate?
I think it's not simply religion, as Ted says. It's also a sense in England of there not being a parliament, of the king being a king not listening to advice, the king being perhaps the prisoner of his evil counsellors, but also perhaps the king himself being to blame. So I think it involves large sections of the population. What's remarkable about the Scottish invasion in August 1640 is, first of all, how difficult it was for the king to raise support against what, in other contexts, the English would have thought of as a foreign invasion. So some of the leading elites won't support him, but also the troops raised, they mutiny. There's riots, and often religious riots. The troops in Essex and other places, they go into the churches and pull down the new altars that the Laudian regime has set up. So, you know, what to their enemies looks like just mob violence is actually, you know, as very often very crafted, deliberate ideological violence. And I think the other political thing that's interesting is once the Scots are ensconced in, you know, they're occupying the north of England, basically, which the people in the north of England aren't entirely happy about. But again, the English reaction is not to want to kick them out, but to take advantage of it so that it becomes very rapidly Parliament's responsibility to raise the money to keep the Scots happy, and Parliament's responsibility to make a treaty with the Scots and arrange eventually, after a long time, for their withdrawal. And it is, I think, quite remarkable how quickly Parliament moves from being something that's called at the will of the monarch irregularly, and no one thinks. Well, some people think there should be regular parliaments, but it's not regarded as improper, you know, not to have one every few years. But very rapidly in 1640, Parliament becomes essentially the government, the executive as well as the legislative. And that, I think, is about a sort of profound ideology that normally a king should rule with Parliament, with the participation of elites. So it's not just about religion. I mean, it's connected because there's, as you've hinted, there's this notion of a popish plot. You know, there's a Catholic plot to undermine true religion, but they always go true religion and the laws of England. And there's a profound, I mean, complicated commitment to the law, because the law, obviously, it's in, you know, it's not always in English. It may favour elites, but there's a widespread commitment to the rule of law in some undefined way, and a notion that if the Catholics were to triumph, they'll have to break English institutions. So it's sort of connected in that way, as well as in what John's point about hierarchy, whether, you know, participation, obedience in the church and the state are obviously closely related, and at what point it's legitimate to be disobedient. And one crucial change, we might be moving on a bit, but one crucial change from James I is, of course, the intended victim of the gunpowder plot, of, you know, Catholic terrorism, whatever you call it. By 1640, 41, there's this great fear that Charles I is not the intended victim of a Catholic plot, but he's implicated in it. He's participating, and that gets more complicated with when there's a revolt in Ireland as well, which brings things to a head.
John, just on the role of Parliament in this, what is clearly quite a feverish period of anxiety about, as Anne has said, the popish plot, the role of the king and the distrust in the king, the different relationships between the different parts of the country itself, whether it's Scotland, Ireland, or England, as well, parts of England too. this conflict with Parliament. Why is he? Well, first of all, the king is dependent on Parliament simply for ensuring that he has the funds coming in to fund the various wars, actions, etc. So he has to call it. But what makes Parliament so suddenly, independently, and almost rebellious?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on exactly the vital point there, John. Parliament has to vote subsidies, has to vote for the finance of the state, and this is a long train coming right back through the parliaments of the 1620s. It's becoming increasingly unwilling to do that unless it gets political concessions out of the crown. So beneath this is this fact, and this is a contemporary speaking, not historians looking back. A contemporary says, look, the House of Commons can buy the House of Lords three times over. In other words, the kind of financial center of the society has moved from the kind of high aristocracy to the local gentry, the merchants, the trading corporations in the city of London. And they are essentially unwilling to grant the king finance unless the king grants them political power. And if the point at which this becomes absolutely explosive is where an already weak central state attempts to fight wars. It blew up in the 1620s because Britain was at war, first of all with Spain, then with France and Spain, and the whole thing explodes in the last Parliament of the 1620s. And if you think they had problems with the hatred towards Lord, that was as nothing compared to the hatred towards the Duke of Buckingham, who's assassinated in the middle of the Parliament meeting to massive applause by at least a considerable section of the population. So we can see, in essence, that crisis has already arrived in the late 1620s and is suppressed by the years of personal rule and explodes again exactly when the country has to go to war with the Scots. So what Parliament is doing here is marking the fact that the kind of economic balance of the country has moved to a group of people that didn't previously have that power and are really demanding that they have the kind of political power that goes with their economic importance.
Let's just come on to some of the chronological events, Ted, because there's always an element of contingency in this, isn't there, as well, as there is in all history. And the way in which, if you like, the relationship between the king and Parliament became not just strained, but there's complete breakdown of trust, duplicity on behalf of the king, but also in Parliament itself, a wide range of views of how things should go forward. Just go through some of the chronological events that developed this breakdown in trust and also this variety, if you like, of solutions that were being put forward.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are a few things to sort of mention. I mean, one is when the Parliament that becomes known as Long Parliament is called to deal with this, you know, this Scottish army that's camped north of England. That Parliament begins in many ways kind of with a lot of agreement about the need to roll back the policies of Charles I's personal rule. That the innovations in the church are innovations. They are things that shouldn't have, you know, taken place. It should move back to a kind of Jacobean, as it's known, sort of compromise. The kind of fiscal expediencies that Charles used to prop up his personal rule, and in particular, ship money, this taxation previously on maritime counties, which was extended to across the country, should be declared illegal. That the prerogative courts that he's been using to silence critics like Prynne and others, should be abolished. There's widespread agreement on these things, as there is also, this hostility that we talked about to key sort of architects of the personal rule. So Lord, but also his Lord Deputy in Ireland, Thomas Wentworth, the Earl of Strafford, another figure who's you know, a sort of a lightning rod for public opposition. I think one thing that's been kind of, you know, we've alluded to this British context, and I think one thing that's been stressed in recent analysis of the kind of the early years of the Long Parliament and the kind of negotiations and struggles between Charles and his opponents is that in some ways the sort of the junto, as it's known, has the sort of leading opponents of Charles I have also got self-preservation on their agenda. Because they have not just, it's not just that they're sort of raising grievances in Parliament, they have actually been in conspiracy, effectively, with the Covenanters. They have been colluding with Charles I's opponents elsewhere. And so there is a personal risk to them if the King is, you know, able to kind of fully recover his own sort of power and to be able to kind of, you know, pursue them effectively as traitors. So there may be a kind of, if you like, personal investment in wanting to clip, you know, the wings of royal power. I think, you know, in terms of what happens over, you know, the course of the 1640 and 1641, we've mentioned one really important issue, and that is Charles's own sort of attitude here. Charles is now in this position where how does he react to these proposals to limit his powers in certain ways, so to limit powers of appointment, for example, and so forth. His position is to think about ways in which he cannot concede, and so he starts to think about effectively seizing power back through a coup. So there's a Tower plot in May of 1641 which fails, and that has in its own way a counter reaction, in that Pym passes through the Commons a sort of English equivalent of the National Covenant, the Protestation of 1641, which is an interesting document because it starts to, in its initial draft anyway, make allegiance to the King very, very obviously conditional on the King's support for an ill-defined reformed Protestant religion. So we get that interplay of religion and politics once again. This is a document which will then go out and be subscribed across the country. So we get, you know, Charles's actions and the anxieties that they produce, creating counter reactions. But we also get the issue of what to do next as well, in particular in the church, causing greater division as well. So, you know, there may be sort of agreement that the Laudian innovations are wrong and they need to be stripped back. But this opens up a space for the discussion of much more radical alternatives. So not a national church upon Episcopal lines, but a Presbyterian church, or perhaps a church which accommodates independent congregations, or perhaps even some radicals, no national church at all, perhaps a very wide religious toleration. And here what you're seeing is actually the radicalizing effect to this of Charles's policies and what's gone on over the 1620s and 30s as well, which is underneath everything, there's really been a kind of fragmentation of English Protestantism, with, you know, Puritanism going off into all sorts of different wings, some of them, you know, seeing themselves as very separate now from this Church of England. And that generates its own anxieties, because you start to see some of the things that Anne has already talked about in relation to what the soldiers were doing in terms of kind of, you know, spontaneous acts of iconoclasm, people destroying Book of Common Prayer. A lot of this actually happening after in London parishes, they've subscribed this protestation. So you get this kind of alignment in some MPs' view of religious radicalism and political radicalism and kind of popular political action. And that leads to kind of people stepping back who had previously been critics of Charles, stepping back and saying, well, maybe we're going too far here. You know, we've unleashed something that is, you know, opening the floodgates to a whole lot of other much more dangerous and much more threatening things, which actually, you know, John was talking about the social position of the Commons, well, which actually maybe threaten the social position of, you know, the gentry who are being represented by the commons as well.
But time and time again, there are attempts to resolve this in negotiation, which the king, by continuing to assert his divine right to rule, is willing to negotiate and do deals with virtually anybody, by the sound of it, to save his own skin and to suppress any form of opposition. There doesn't seem to be any element of compromise coming from the king, which then leads on to almost, well, not inevitable, but leads to, well, regicide, as described. You know, the chopping a king's head off.
it takes a while, I think. I mean, there are attempts at compromise, but I think that they're always, as Ted says, sort of cut across by attempts to regain, you know, if we're talking about before the war breaks out, to recover his position by force. But I think in the early 40s, it's very important to stress what Ted has hinted at popular mobilisation. You know, as Parliament becomes divided, you can't have a civil war without a royalist party. And one thing that happens is, as Ted says, elements of the elites think it's not worth the risk. But what's also happening in London particularly, but not just in London, is that Parliament is also seen as a representative of the people. The more radical members of Parliament, including, you know, some in the House of Lords, are in touch with radical figures in London. So one crucial reason why Charles I loses the Civil War is that over the winter of 1641-2, he's forced from London, essentially by popular protests. There are moves to remove the bishops from the House of Lords, which would give the sort of a resistance to the king a majority in the House of Lords. There are demonstrations that block the bishops going into the House of Lords. There are calls for the impeachment of the Queen, who's a Catholic. And in many days of crisis following Charles' attempts to arrest leading members of Parliament. They lock the door against him, and the five members flee to the city of London and are defended by the London militia, who come out and watch and then escorted back to Parliament. And Charles leaves London, he leaves London in, well, I never know precise dates, but January 1642, and he only comes back to be tried and executed. And Parliament sitting in London, having access to the wealth and the loans and all the rest of it of the City of London, is a very, very important element in why they win the Civil War. And then eventually, you know, radical minority bring him to trial and execute him. But it's very important that there is widespread popular mobilization winter of 41-2, in support of or even pushing along the radical MPs and radical peers in the Parliament.
Okay. Yeah. And I think if I could just sort of come in, I think the other thing we've got to add into the mix in this period, in kind of late 41, early 42, is the situation in Ireland as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
There's been a rebellion in Ireland led by the Catholic elite, in which thousands of Protestants are killed. The numbers that are killed are grossly exaggerated in English press reports, and it's reported as if it's effectively a kind of genocide of the Protestant population in Ireland. And this leads to an enormous amount of anxiety, because, as we've said, those are sort of established beliefs in a Popish plot, which increasingly the king is seen as possibly being a party to rather than being, you know, the victim of. And that's exacerbated by this Irish rebellion, because it's rumoured that the Irish rebels have received a royal commission for what they're doing, that they're actually in cahoots with the king. And so what that does is obviously that enormously ramps up the anxiety in England itself, but it also turns the attention very much towards questions of security. And so it's moving it from, you know, political division and controversy into saying, well, we've got to protect ourselves. You know, we could be at the mercy of an Irish Catholic army. We could be, you know, slaughtered by Irish Catholics. We've got to start kind of, you know, moving towards, you know, military solutions to this crisis.
Can I just mention one other thing that we haven't talked about, but I think is actually also crucially important, is the role of print and also increasing literacy. It's a period where literacy is obviously socially connected. You're more likely to be literate if you're a man, if you're a rich man, if you live in the town, not the countryside. But it's been it's over the generations where people are becoming more literate, and probably most people in London could read. Well, certainly perhaps half of women, you know, more than that. So it's a period where literacy and reading is a bit, even if you can't do it, it's like computing. You know, even if you can't do it, you've got neighbours who can do it. Children are more literate than their parents. So, and you've got what you've got in the, as John said right at the beginning, the church censors print. But what you get in the early 40s with the fall of the bishops, you get the end of effective censorship. You know, then, you know, there's attempts through the 40s to bring it back. So you get popular participation and mobilisation reported on, encouraged, made possible by print, so that the protestation oath that that Ted mentioned is rolled out across the country through printed directives that then people sit in their parish churches, young men, women, including, take this oath sort of to Protestant religion, petitions, newspapers, the first regular printed newspapers describing domestic news, not foreign news, come out just really at the time of the Irish Rebellion and the time of what's called the Grand Remonstrance, a great manifesto about the evils of Charles I's reign. And I think a lot that happens throughout the Civil War and the radicalisation, particularly on the Parliament side, is publicised, the same, mobilised, made possible, spread through print to a newly literate, excited, engaged population.
Thanks, Anne, for that. That's exactly the perfect hook to move on then to, let's talk about the range of debate that's going on within society at that time, and in particular, John, within the army. And of course, let's talk about the levellers, the diggers, and other elements of that debate.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, both Ted and Anne have made the point about popular mobilisation and the relationship of the explosion of popular print to that process. And that has a direct effect on how the war is fought. So, for instance, the battle that keeps Charles I from retaking London at the beginning of the war, which is Brentford and Turnham Green. Brentford on the first day is a bloody battle which just about halts the advance of the Royalist troops into London. Turnham Green on the second day is a kind of standoff between the armies, but the standoff on the Parliament side is of Londoners pouring out of the city. It's a kind of like a giant picnic on a battlefield. They bring food, they bring beer, the wives come, the whole population transports itself out to Turnham Green and sits there looking at the Royalists until the Royalists decide there's too many of them and clear off back to Oxford. London constructed an entire wall around the city, the so-called lines of communication, a defensive embankments and fortifications. That was done by ordinary citizens under the mobilizing power of the London guilds, pouring out men, women, children every day and building 18 miles of fortifications around the city. So this business of popular mobilization is now in the bloodstream of the revolution from very early on. And it's beginning to form an ideology as well. Parliament has to justify why it's resisting the lawful monarch. And it develops so-called resistance theory, that if a monarch sort of goes off his head, then it's all right to oppose him. This ends up in the kind of popular parliamentary Latin tag of Salus Populi Supremus Lex. The safety of the people is the highest law. So this has revolutionary implications. So even though parliamentary armies are going into battle with the king, with on their battle flags for king and parliament, i.e. we're the true preservers of the old constitution, it's Charles who's breaking all the traditional ways down, we're just trying to get back to life as normal. That's one kind of ideological argument that's going on. But there's another very, very powerful one, which over time supplants it, which is actually the House of Commons is the true representative of the people, and that ought to be elected. It ought to be properly elected with a wide franchise. And this is what the radicals are beginning to say. So right the way through the war and into the post-war period, where the question gets asked, what is the country going to look like? What's the constitution of the country going to be? These two dynamics are running, a kind of loyalist and conservative dynamic. We want a quick peace. We want a return to normal. We just want the king to behave himself. And this other dynamic, which is, hang on, there's something fundamentally wrong here and something fundamental needs to change. And to do that, we've got to beat the king well and thoroughly on the battlefield. And of course, Oliver Cromwell becomes the key exponent of that view. You know, I would as soon discharge my pistol upon the king as upon any private man. In other words, don't bother me with all this stuff about a limited war. If I see the king on a battlefield, he's going to get a pistol ball, same as anybody else. So, you know, which Cromwell then retreats from after the war, but that's the kind of win the war position. And that radicalizes people in the army. It radicalizes people in London and the urban centers. They're beginning to build popular organization of one form or another. They're beginning to develop political programs which represent that. So this is where everything begins to move now very sharply into a highly polarized political environment.
I'd just like to stress very briefly too that the actual impact of fighting the war itself and paying for the war, that it used to be thought it was a relative, you know, it's a very significant number of men are probably in arms. People, statistics are very hard, but people said proportionally more people may have died in the English Civil War than died in the First World War. I mean, the numbers are much smaller. So I think the sort of, if you like, the sort of practical impacts of that, people talk about all the blood and treasure that's been spilt in the war. And as John says, for some people, then their reaction is, let's just stop it, peace at any price. But for very significant groups, they say, well, we've been called out to fight. You know, the blood and treasure has been spilt. What reward is there for ordinary people who have fought this war? And hence you get demands, Putney debates, other demands for political change and sometimes for social change.
Right, you've opened it up now at the reference to the Putney debates, Anne. Just coming back to you, John, just take us through the way in which on the left, let's call it that, of these debates with the Levellers Diggers and into the Putney debates themselves and some of the individuals involved. Just trace through how that debate has evolved.
Well, it comes out of, as we've all been saying, out of the upheaval of the war, a unique degree of social dislocation, as contemporaries had it, the world turned upside down. And the question was then, well, what are we going to do now? What's the country going to look like? And ordinary people felt engaged in that. The fact that they'd given so much themselves made them feel that they were entitled to have a view on that. And political groups like the Levellers John Lilburne, the most famous of them, himself a soldier, himself imprisoned by Charles I in the 1630s. In other words, in many ways, I mean, he saw himself certainly, and with some justification, as being the personification of the persecution that people had endured under Charles, and of the blood and money that they'd spent in order to win the war, and he grouped around him, actually a very particular group of people, often London apprentices, often the second sons of gentry, exactly the kind of people that were literate, were running the illegal printing presses, producing the illegal pamphlets, mobilising people at Westminster, fighting the royalists in Westminster Hall in order at the very beginning of the revolution. And so they begin to form a programme, the Agreement of the People. It's presented at Putney in a debate, which includes people, the agitators from the New Model Army, and this is as unique as anything that happens in a period where unique things are happening, where the regiments of the army, rather than being disbanded by the Peace Party at Parliament, have elected their own representative. Regiment after regiment, first in the cavalry, then in the infantry, elect their own representatives, and these people are in command of the army and earn and have such power that the grandees, as the levellers call them, the leaders of the army, have to sit down with them at Putney and have a debate on equal terms about what the settlement of the nation is going to be. And these ideas about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to organise, freedom of the press, and an extended franchise are all on the table there. And that really is the birth of modern democratic politics.
The debates in Putney happen. The radical debates take place. You then moves from the levellers into a much wider debate about the ownership of property by the diggers themselves and Gerard Winstanley. Early forms of communism are taking place right the way across the country itself. So this moves from just a constitutional debate to something much more fundamental about the distribution of wealth and power, Ted.
Yeah, I think also these kinds of demands are actually present in discussions in the army as well. And I think it's important not just to sort of limit those kinds of discussions about the economic and social makeup of the country to the diggers and to Winstanley. Obviously, Winstanley is the most celebrated example of, trying to put an idea of communal life and doing away with private property and land into some form of practice. But if you, for example, to look at the petitions that army regiments issue in the winter of 48, which are often associated with calls just for the execution of the king, there are a lot of demands in those petitions for addressing the social ills of the country that are saying, we've had, as Anna said, this devastating conflict. And what have we got to show for it? Well, we need to... we need to look after those who've been affected by this conflict. We need to look after the poor. We need to look after widows and orphan children. And we need to create a system in society which will support these people, those who are, the more vulnerable, the less well off. So we need to think about things like hospitals. We need to think about taxing more fairly. We need to think about a legal system which is fairer and which can easily be understood by ordinary people, which isn't at all of the powerful and the propertied. So those calls, I think, it's important to acknowledge they're actually more broadly based than that. There's actually a lot of discussion going on around these issues. But, obviously Winstanley and the diggers are the most famous example of this. And I think they're really interesting because they show us the real kind of radicalizing effect and potential of the revolution. So Winstanley starts to write his what we crudely could call more politically engaged works in the wake of the execution of the king and the establishment of a republic. And there's a real sense in which he sees these political changes as things which are, ushering in and legitimating the kind of society he thinks needs to be established, a society in which private ownership of land is done away with, in which, living in these kind of communal settlements becomes the way in which people will live in a society which isn't going to be, you know, dominated by hierarchy and possession. So he's a real example of somebody who's, you know, connection with the wider politics and reading of all this kind of news media we've been talking about leads to this real kind of, you know, development of this radical vision and implementation of that radical vision in practice.
Yeah, he has a very broad connection, very broad conception of what kingly power is. And I mean, there is, I think he is very distinctive, and it's a sort of prefigurative, performative. They're not necessarily poor, the diggers. They're demonstrating how they want a society to work. And it suggests the sort of, and it's a very powerful biblical vision about how the fall of man has corrupted the very earth and the way and all human relationships. But I think, as Ted says, there's a very broader notion of how society must be improved and how political change is not enough, which, you know, and also disillusion to some extent, which certainly when the levellers are all locked up in the tower in 1649, they're saying, you know, we're England's, they issue a pamphlet called England's New Chains, you know, that actually getting rid of the king at the top, you know, wasn't enough. You needed further change, which, you know, doesn't necessarily occur, but does show the potential of the sort of imagination, I suppose, connected to a time of great upheaval and dislocation, the potential in the ideas.
Yeah, I think the chronology is very, very important here, because while the levellers precede and are part of the process of achieving the revolution, the diggers don't really even appear on the scene until after the king's been executed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they and the ranters that talked a lot about, you know, challenging religion and the kind of sexual mores of the day, they're part of a kind of reaction to that fact, because, you know, it's hard for us to imagine how incredible the execution of the king must have been. You know, monarchs have lost their lives before, murdered by their family, whatever, but never like this. They've never been put on trial for treason against the people. That would have been you could only be treasonable against the king. The king couldn't be treasonable against the people. It was a ridiculous thought until they were put on public trial. And, you know, one of the registrars said it wasn't a thing done in a corner. We did it publicly. John Milton, the greatest poet of the age, is writing pamphlets defending it as foreign secretary in the new government. So it's a mind-blowing experience. And from that comes the sort of possibility of imagining other mind-blowing things might happen. And so it's a kind of ideological reaction to that, both to the fact of it and, as Anne says, to the disappointment that it hasn't immediately all. You know, I mean, there were people around who thought this was going to presage the second coming of Jesus Christ. So it's a bit of a disappointment to find that John Milburn's in the tower. So that combination of kind of opening up and simultaneous disappointment produces a kind of ideological tsunami across sections of the society.
All these new vistas of a new society are opened up. The Commonwealth takes place, Cromwell's protectorate. Cromwell then dies. His son, Richard, tries to succeed him, doesn't last, and then there's the Restoration. What, though, were the lasting impacts of this revolutionary period? What penetrated in the long term that we can look back on? I can appreciate that for a long period, people just wanted stability, that the Civil War itself had been so traumatic, they may well welcome the Restoration and just stabilize things for a period, not even wanting to mention the Civil War because of its bloody consequences. But there were lasting consequences. There were lasting impacts of this debate that took place and these actions that took place. What do you think they were, Ted?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is to pick up a word that you just used, John, which is trauma. And this is a society that has been traumatized, and it is actually not possible for people to forget. I mean, there are literal legislative attempts to kind of enforce a type of forgetting through the Act of Oblivion and Indemnity, but that's, you know, it's not in any sense really effective. You know, obviously there are lots of people living who'd experienced the conflict. There are, you know, people who do still actually want to continue to pursue, if you like, the aims of the good old cause in early 1660s England. So, we get rebellions in the early 1660s, which are led by former New Model Army soldiers who want to kind of continue the good fight. So it is not a conflict that's done and dusted in some ways by 1660. And it's also a conflict who the memory of, I think, really continues to shape political debates and political divisions through the later 17th century. It's used as a way of slurring opponents, of pointing to people's connections, you know, with the parliamentarian side. Is particularly used against nonconformists to connect them to, you know, radical Puritanism during the 1640s and 1650s. So it's a really important context for politics in the later 17th century. I mean, I've got one example of, you know, how long the shadow is, which is, you mentioned Richard Cromwell. There's a declaration of loyalty to Richard Cromwell that the good burghers of Great Yarmouth sign in 1658, I should say, which resurfaces in the 1670s and 1680s, because it's used as a way of saying, look, these people signed this thing, you know, these guys are, it's the same, they're the same parliamentarians, they need to be purged from the corporation. 100 years later, the local press is still going on about this thing and saying, you know, these people, they're the same people, they're the descendants of the radical parliamentarians, and, you know, we've got to keep them out. So it has this, it's such a traumatic event. It's so divisive. It, you know, there's such an upheaval, the execution of the king, establishment of a republic, that it just, you know, it can't be papered over, and it continues to be this thing that is referred back to again and again, and continues to kind of shape and structure political and religious debate and controversy.
I mean, the issues aren't settled in 1660, and I mean, more prosaically, I mean, Protestant religious uniformity is never re-established. You know, dissenters, people who won't accept the Church of England, are intermittently persecuted, and then the most respectable of them, but also including Quakers, get toleration in 1689. So, and religious fragmentation has a very important political and cultural sort of impact. The other thing, the most radical ideas perhaps are tamed for us, but they're not forgotten particularly. And there's elements, aren't there, of levellers in mid-18th century republicanism, and also Chartists. But also, I think what also happens, John made the very important point, you had a weak central state in the 60s, you know, the actual potential military and fiscal power of the state is very significantly strengthened in the 1640s and 50s. The dominance of England, with drastic consequences, obviously, for Ireland, and less drastic but significant consequences for England, is a permanent feature. You know, it's a darker feature, but it's a permanent feature. And so I think, you know, it's often said it's the 1690s and the wars of the 1690s that lead to a strengthened military fiscal state. But I do think the mid-17th century is very important. But going along with, people remain divided locally about Parliament, about religion, about the nature of the monarchy.
Certain rights are established, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually, because of this uprising revolution, we do get to a situation where, yes, there is an element of religious toleration taking place eventually. Mm-hmm. There are civil liberties that are established. Parliament and regular elections take place. So within the next century, at least, all these implications come from the fact we've had a revolution in this way. And certainly no monarch can ever rule again the way in which Charles II sought to rule. But actually, in the longer term, in terms of the development, I speak as a socialist, it has become historically a source of reference, certainly in the last century, for the way in which socialists and the labour and trade union movement in this country has developed its ideas as well. And it isn't just the historians who've revitalised the understanding of the Levellers and Winstanley and the Diggers and what this revolution meant. It did penetrate into the common speeches of MPs like Tony Benn and others. So it's had a renewal, hasn't it, over the last century of its influence, John?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say the debate over democracy is never over. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're used to the idea that some of the things that were fought for and argued for by the Levellers and subsequent generations who repeated many of their claims, the Chartists, annual parliaments, it's there just as it was in the agreement of the people and so forth. But they always stand under threat, even in the most advanced of parliamentary democracies. And, you know, I was lucky enough to participate in the Egyptian Revolution. In every society where there's a tyrannical or autocratic form of government and people rise against it, the patterns of debate and argument are remarkably similar, given the gap of 350, 400 years. So that debate never closes. And I don't think it's ever really closed in British society either. I mean, John will know that the only reason there is a statue of Oliver Cromwell outside the Houses of Parliament are A, because it was paid for by private subscription because the state refused to pay for it, and B, it stands outside because they refused to have it inside the Houses of Parliament. You know, when Winston Churchill wanted to name a battleship Cromwell, the royal family vetoed it on the basis that it was rude about the ancestors' fate. So, I mean, these echoes continue. And to go back to their point of origin, to see where they were forged and how much people gave to forge them, I think is a necessary part of anybody in the labour movement's intellectual makeup, really.
Yeah. Could I just add, because I think we tend to think about, you know, what are the ramifications or successes from this activity in the English Revolution, you know, what the Levellers were arguing for, in terms of, you know, where we are now in terms of modern democracy. And so it's almost, you know, that case of, well, you know, it was a failure in its time, but, you know, as we look down the years, we've got finally towards this sort of point. I think it's worth understanding what these groups achieved in their time as well, and appreciating that, and appreciating that in fact they made significant changes to society in their own era. And it is not a case that, you know, we had to wait, you know, 300 odd years for this to bear fruit. I mean, we can't imagine, I think, the kind of vibrant political culture that develops in later 17th and early 18th century England without the Civil War and without the activities of groups like the Levellers. They transform how you use print, how you organise, how you promote a cause. And these are real legacies, as is that debate around toleration, you know, putting that squarely on the agenda, the national agenda, as something that remains a constant debating point through the late 17th and on into the 18th century. So, you know, we don't just have to look at this as sort of, you know, this is something that was, you know, wonderful ideas that didn't come to fruition. These were things that did have a real impact. And they did have a real legacy, you know, in the 17th century itself.
Thanks to our participants. And I hope that this episode has given you some idea of the impact of the Civil War, not just on the 17th century, but on the politics of the next 360 years.